Hello, welcome to the Theology Etc. podcast. As usual, I'm Forrest Animaceris. Today, I'm sitting down with Andy Bomberger. Andy Bomberger is a good guy. I've had him in, we've been in a handful of classes together.
Yeah, a few classes.
Kind of an unusual amount compared to most other people I went to college with. Like, I felt like there were like 2 years where it was like almost every class I had with you. And we sat within like a 5
Yeah, I think we sat by each other in most of those classes.
Yeah, so really good guy. He's from Chattanooga, Tennessee. He's actually double majoring in biblical studies and English, which is going to factor into the conversation we're going to have today a little bit. But Andy, just want to say thanks for coming on the show. And
yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, man. No problem. So Andy, you are an English major and a Bible major, which means one of two things. Either one, you're a glutton for punishment. Or maybe it's like a both and, but also you're interested in both those things, I'm guessing.
Right, yeah.
Those really aren't majors I feel like people are pressured into doing. Like, no offense to like accountants, but whenever I meet somebody and they're studying accounting, I'm like, is that really
what you want to do? Dream? Like, who grows up like wanting to be an accountant?
Yeah, just like, I guess some people, you know, I'm just fascinated with numbers. Yeah, I love laws. I don't know. Numbers and laws, I guess that's really all accounting is. But so you've got this interest in English and Bible, and I think it's really interesting. I think it's really cool. And one of the things that we've talked about a little bit before, but I think this brings out, is you and people like you who study both of these, you know, fields of study, maybe had a propensity to appreciate the Bible more for some of its literary components.
Yeah.
So what, going with that, what does that really mean? Like, if you say you appreciate the literary quality of the Bible, or you appreciate its literary value, like, what really are you saying there?
Yeah. This English literature is something that has always, you know, kind of interested me. I've always been a big reader. And when people ask me why I chose Bible and English, my response is I really want to be poor like that.
Yes.
That's my ultimate desire. But it really is because I want to go into ministry, and a lot of people were telling me that, you know, you need to have something else that you're interested in, or that, you know, another degree that you can use either in ministry or to kind of have as a backup. So I just kind of chose that because it's something I liked and enjoyed. But it's kind of been amazing to me how well they have complemented each other. And I think what you're saying there, I feel like studying literature and what makes good literature has been really important for me, because it just kind of changes the way I approach the Bible. And I think what it does, it helps you appreciate the Bible for its context and its intent and its meaning. And if you're not looking at the Bible as a literary document or designed as literature, then you're not really grasping what the author meant to get across originally. So there is a purpose behind why a book of the Bible is written in poetry form or in narrative style or whatever genre it is. And if you don't appreciate that and try to see what the author is doing, you lose kind of the beauty of the communication, but also the meaning of what is trying to be communicated there. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think sometimes, you know, perhaps unfortunately, we kind of rush to reading the Bible for the sake of just kind of skipping to the last step. It's like, okay, I'm going to open my Bible, I'm going to read what it says, and I'm going to rush to, what does this mean for me? Like, how does this apply to my context? And we kind of forget, hold on a second, there's a genre in which this is written. There are, you know, maybe there's figures of speech involved. Maybe there's, you know, there's all these literary things going on that kind of almost act as clues, maybe serve as clues to what the original intent of that was to its original audience. And then we kind of have to do that before we get to, okay, what does this mean for me?
Right.
But people kind of in a hurry to, maybe they're ignorant of things like that, or maybe they just, for whatever reason, they've never really cared about it. You know what I mean? So they just kind of rush into it. But I think in our day and age, people might be afraid to admit they appreciate the Bible for its literary form, you know, because there's a lot of people out there in the world, you know, who say the Bible is just another book, and we can't really trust that it's inspired by God. It's certainly not infallible. I'm just going to read it like I would, I don't know, you know, I'm going to read a psalm like I would a sonnet from Shakespeare or something like that, and I can appreciate it and respect it, but I'm really not Like, this isn't transformative for me on a spiritual level. You know, so why is that not something we have to be afraid of? Like, how can we appreciate the Bible for its literary qualities while still maintaining that it is, you know, unique and God-breathed, etc.?
Yeah, and I think that's a valid concern, because you don't want to say this is just a man-made thing, a book just like any other thing. And I think a lot of times, if you, especially with the narrative parts of the Bible, people are very concerned that you don't say it's constructed as a piece of literature, because that makes you think, well, those events didn't really happen. They're not true.
Right.
But I don't necessarily see a disconnect there. I think it can still be true, but also still the details included in the narrative, the way the narrative is structured, this story is placed next to this story, can provide a lot of rich meaning. And I think it actually, rather than making it just like any other book or calling into question inspiration, I think looking at the Bible as great literature, the best literature, actually affirms inspiration, because you see all these narrative threads throughout the Bible, and all there's this literary connection in individual books, but also in the overarching story of Scripture. And it's pretty beautiful to see how it works together. And so I think that really changes the way that we view the Bible, and also changes the way that we see God. And I think what you were saying earlier is so interesting in this discussion, because I think people do want to just open up their Bible and get something to help them get through the day, or like see something that applies to them. But that's not really what the Bible claims to be, and not really what the Bible was designed to be. It's not a set of rules in of itself. It has rules, it has commandments. And I think if you talk about the Bible as literary, I think some people might be skeptical, because they think you're trying to get rid of the commandments and you're not trying to follow God's rule book. Yeah. I think there's a problem with just seeing the Bible as God's guidebook or basic instructions before leaving Earth. I don't know if you've heard that before.
Yeah, definitely.
Which it is those things in general, but I think it's so much more than that. It's not just something to follow or a checklist. I think it's designed literarily because it's supposed to shape us and affect our emotions. And great poetry, great narrative does that. And it's supposed to challenge us. It's not supposed to give us just the easy answers. And that's part of the process of how I think God changes us. It's through poetry. It's through stories. It's through these literary tactics that don't just give us, you know, line by line instructions on how to live life, although there is, you know, wisdom for how to live life, and we know that we find everything that we need to live this life well in the Bible, but it doesn't do it in the way that we always expect it to do.
Right.
It's more of a slow cutting process. The Bible's a sword. It's not just a guidebook or a rule book.
Definitely. That's a good point. I think maybe a couple of things. First, maybe we approach the Bible almost looking for like bullet points. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like even like a narrative, you know?
Right.
It's like maybe you're reading 2 Samuel and it's like David did this, then David did this, then David did this, then David did this. But that's not really, I mean, that's not going to engage anybody. You know what I mean? And that's kind of almost unnatural and alien to how we communicate with each other, and certainly, you know, how God communicates. So that's a good point. And two, I think there might be people out there who just have never really enjoyed reading the Bible. You know what I mean? They've never really looked at it from that perspective, because they're only going to the Bible in order to win an argument or defend an argument, or to, you know, what am I going to preach this week? What am I going to teach this week? Or how can I use this to make somebody feel guilty or whatever it is, instead of actually sitting down and reading the Bible? And I think that's kind of maybe changing. And I think something that might be changing this is how Bibles are starting to be made. Like, you know, you kind of have almost this revolution for like reader's Bibles.
Oh, yeah.
And all these publishing companies are making Bibles, you know, without chapter or verse numbers. And it's, you know, single paragraph text, and you're reading, and it's almost like a normal book that you would read. And it's not that you're devaluing it, but books are designed to be read, almost with the exception of the Bible. You know what I mean? Like, they've got all this stuff in the gutters, and you've got these, like, two, like, narrow columns, and you got all this other stuff that distracts you. So I think it's cool. Like, maybe there is kind of, like, a turning point here where people are like, no, the Bible, it is God-breathed, and it is my guide, but also I love to read it. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, right? Shouldn't we... Doesn't God expect us to want to read what he wrote?
Yeah, and I think there is kind of a push toward that, and I definitely appreciate that. And I'm also thankful for chapter divisions and verse numbers and things like that, because it's so helpful. But I think there's also a danger there, because like you're saying, you can just pick out this verse for your own purpose and whatever you need right then. But the Bible wasn't meant to be read that way, like you're saying. I think so much of this, viewing the Bible literarily, comes down to just reading whole books at a time and not just, you know, reading one chapter. I mean, that's a lot easier to swallow for, you know, a lot of us who are really busy in the world we live in. But I think we ought to read whole books at a time if we can, because we're supposed to sit with the Bible and meditate upon it. And, you know, that's kind of the picture of... a good student of scripture that we see in Psalms, like Psalm 1 or Psalm 119. It's someone who is engaging with the text and meditating upon it and thinking about it and letting it challenge him and seeing it for what it is and not just picking it out for a particular purpose. Right. It's an approach to scripture that says, I'm just going to let this do to me what it was intended to do, and I'm just going to try to hear what God is saying to me rather than going in looking for something.
Absolutely. I think that's a good distinction, and kind of, I guess, keeping in mind that the Bible is, you know, a literary product, God-inspired still, don't get me wrong, but it is a literary product. That can kind of help us want to dive into it a little bit more. You know, you're not reading just like a grocery list. Nobody sits down and enjoys reading a grocery list. But God's given us something a lot more interesting. So kind of turning it on to maybe like a more personal aspect, as somebody who's kind of at this intersection of studying studying literature, studying English, studying the Bible, is there something in God's Word that kind of sticks out to you as an example of good literature? Now, obviously, like all of it, I think, is, you know, to some degree... But is there something that really, like, sticks out and you're like, wow, this is, like, masterful? Like, even if you didn't believe the Bible was inspired, you'd be like, this is great literature.
I think where you have to start in that conversation is the book of Genesis, which, you know, I mean, that's the first book in the Bible, obviously.
Yeah.
But it is a literary masterpiece. And literally, the rest of the Bible is playing on... the themes and the ideas and the imagery all found from Genesis. Especially the first three chapters of Genesis are just packed with, you know, the problem of humanity and who God is and what his purpose for this earth is. And over in the book of Genesis, that story is kind of replayed out. You know, for example, some of the language used for... Adam and Eve's sin is kind of replayed in the Cain and Abel story, and over when man decides to sin and rebel against God, there's this common theme throughout. And another interesting thing that I've been studying recently, because I actually wrote a paper on it recently, but something I hadn't particularly noticed before reading Genesis is this common theme of the second-born son being favored over the first-born son. And you see that over and over in the book of Genesis. And, you know, if you just read the book as fragmented stories, which sometimes we do because we've grown up in Sunday school where each week is a different story, and you don't read it together, you might not see that. For example, Abel was favored over Cain, and Jacob over Esau, and Isaac over Ishmael. And even Ephraim and Manasseh, we see that. And then Joseph, he's the youngest brother. He's favored over. Yeah. It's just like so many times in the book, there's this theme, and it causes the reader to think, why is that you know, we know that these are true events, but why is that such an emphasis in the text and in the way that God works?
Right.
And that's just one example of a theme of so many themes that flow throughout the book of Genesis. And so I think for me, Genesis is pretty amazing in that regard as far as a literary book that you can see its beauty. And I think you could sit down with Genesis for years and not see, you know, everything that's there. And I don't know, are you a fan of the Bible Project?
Have you looked
at their stuff before? They really try to approach the Bible in a literary nature, and they have a lot of great material on how the themes stem a lot from Genesis. So mm-hmm. I think for me, it's pretty exciting to view it in that way and approach it in that way.
Definitely. Yeah, that's great. I recently read through, I mean, I didn't read through in a day, but I say recently, at the turn of the year, like most people, you know, I was trying to read the Bible in a year. I'm still plugging along. I'm in Chronicles, somewhere in Chronicles.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Haven't quit yet. But I remember leaving Genesis so impressed because I'd never really read it. You know, I didn't read it all in one sitting, but maybe like 10 chapters a day,
right.
You know, at least. And then after I finished Genesis, I was like, whoa, like that was like way, I don't mean to sound like a heathen, but like almost better than I expected.
Yeah.
Like, if that makes sense. Like just because the picture I had of Genesis before was always like these snapshots. Like, okay, God creates everything out of nothing. Got it. Adam and Eve sin. Okay, got it. You know, Cain and Abel story. Okay, got it. Noah's flood. Okay, got it. Then you skip ahead to like Abraham. Okay, got it. Then you really like, it's like next thing is Joseph and then you're done. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's like Genesis. But when you read it and there's all these things and these interludes and these themes, and it's just, it's great. So I'm really, that wasn't what I was expecting you to say.
Yeah.
So I'm really, really glad you touched on Genesis there. Yeah, that's really, really cool stuff. And one thing, I think this goes to, kind of just like a side note, goes to what you're saying, that theme of, you know, like the second born son or the younger son kind of being celebrated over the firstborn. I think that is kind of, at least for me when I read it, almost part of this bigger theme of God isn't necessarily doing what you're expecting him to, you know, and he's taking this stuff and it's just like totally different. Like even if, you know, when you study like ancient Near Eastern cosmologies around Israel, like even the first three chapters is not what you would expect.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then it just keeps on going. It's just like, it's not what you would expect. You know, God, you can't really fashion him after your own mind because he's doing these things that, you know, if you were calling the shots, you would never do.
Right.
You know, and then, but it's like, no, I'm sovereign. I'm in charge. So I really like that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Genesis. Absolutely. Okay. So you kind of touched on this a little bit, like that theme of the second born son, and some of the other things you mentioned, I'm not necessarily going to get that unless I'm thinking while I'm reading, which hopefully I'm doing, you know what I mean?
Right.
But to be honest with you, sometimes I'm not, you know what I mean?
Like
sometimes we're like, okay, I got to read however many chapters today. I'm just going to unplug and just do it and get it over with. So these literary things and scriptures, you really kind of have to be thinking. You have to be chewing on it. You have to be digging to find some of these. And I guess the question for you is it really worth the work? You know, like if I know I'm saved and I know I'm on the right path and I know I'm a part of the right church and I'm just reading to check it off the list. Is it really a big deal if I don't notice that the second born son keeps on getting elevated? You know what I mean? Like, is it really worth the work and the energy and the thought to kind of get away with some of these things that definitely add to my understanding, but they're not necessarily like essential.
Essential. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I think that's a really valid question because, you know, that I see that in my own attitude sometimes, you know, I just want to, you know, feel like I've done my reading that I need to do for today and get through it. But when I have approached the Bible intentionally and trying to hear what God has to say and looking for those things and digging and trying to do deep study, I've never regretted it.
Yeah.
And I think it's again, it goes back to a way of thinking about the Bible. Is it just something that helps me get to heaven? Well, yes, it does do that. Is it just something that I have to check off of my list to feel like a good Christian today? Well, Maybe yeah. That is part of it. But the way I see the Bible, and I think the way the Bible presents itself, is that it wasn't designed just for those purposes. It was mainly in design to tell us about who God is. And that, I think that's really profound, that God is saying, I want you to know who I am, because I know you, and I'm revealing things about myself through this medium of this book. And that's a beautiful thing. And I think it's digging into the literary aspects of the Bible is not just an intellectual exercise or saying, oh, I found this cool thing that runs throughout, which is a temptation for me to do and just say, oh, this is cool. Like, I really like this connection, or I really like that this idea comes out.
Right.
But it's about knowing God and about seeing a deeper meaning there, rather than just having a surface level reading of the text. And so you get such a richer portrait of who God is, I think, if you view the Bible in this way.
Definitely. That's a good point. And not to turn kind of this literary study into just for the sake of argumentation, etc., but it even does help with that. You know, me,
yeah.
Especially, like, one of my main interests, as you know, is apologetics. And I see all the time, and I've done it myself in the past before I was a Christian, like, skeptics of the Bible will make totally ridiculous conclusions from the text because they don't respect the literary genre that it's written in,
right,
or some literary form or some figure of speech or whatever it is. So these things do help us in interpretation, you know what I mean? And they absolutely do help us actually try to get to the bottom of what God is trying to tell us. Going with that, this is just a curiosity to me. I haven't studied a whole lot of literature. I've only studied what I needed to.
Right.
to get degrees, etc., graduate, all that good stuff. So, like, in your experience, kind of comparing what we have in the Bible to what we have written by men, and I know there's some great works by men out there, don't get me wrong, not trying to devalue those. Like, is there really, like, a difference here? You know what I mean? Like, when you take the Bible on its own compared to some literary great work on the other side, like on the scales, you know what I mean? And I'm not saying necessarily that the Bible is better literature, but when you weigh it up, is there, like, at least in your opinion, do you look at that and say, okay, one of these is for sure from God, and you can tell when you compare it to the other?
Yeah, I think the big difference there is that you don't see such a masterful literary design and continuous theme and all these things working together in a work that was written by so many various authors. Like, I can pick up a book written by a famous author and I can appreciate it for its literary design, but the Bible is different in that it was produced over a span of thousands of years, and I see themes in the New Testament and ideas in the New Testament and things that connect so well with things that were written, you know, thousands of years before. And I think it's that scale where it all fits together that really sets the Bible apart, when you have all these different authors across different time periods, and they're all not giving us things that uphold themselves as authors or lift themselves up, but they all center around God and his plan for the universe and who he is and his character. And I think that's pretty amazing that all of these books fit together so well in that way. And I think that's one of the best things about the Bible, that God chose to communicate in that way, is that it is a fully divine project, but it's also a fully human project. And I think that also reflects something about our Savior, who we know was fully human and fully divine, and who was described as the Word, you know, come down to us. So I think that's a pretty interesting thing to think about when we think about the Bible. It's that we know it's God-breathed, we know it's divine, but it's also something that God brings humans along for the ride and asks them to be a part of this really amazing project that he's doing.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. I never really thought about it like that, but that's, yeah, that's awesome. And even, I think, goes to show something about God, you know, and his concern for us and as humans. So kind of switching gears here a little bit, going from the neglected, perhaps, aspect of appreciating the Bible from a literary perspective, let's go to the neglected aspect of kind of a subgenre, I guess. Yeah, subgenre.
Yeah.
Right? You're the Englishman.
Yeah.
Okay, subgenre in the Bible of the minor prophets, you know, Hebrew perspective known as the Book of the Twelve. I can't rattle them off. I never learned the song as a kid.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got a lot of good stuff in there, and sometimes it's neglected as a whole. You know, we might have a couple verses here and there we click on. But why do you think that is? Why do you think the minor prophets are easy to neglect?
Yeah, and I think it actually does connect to our conversation we were just having. I think it is a lack of familiarity with the literary style of the prophets. There's a lot of dense poetry and some weird imagery in the minor prophets. And also, this is not necessarily a literary thing, but there's a lot of historical context that we don't get,
right,
which is not really that difficult in our world that we live in today to figure out and to find out, because there's a lot of clues in the Bible and there's limitless resources online and in books to kind of figure out that stuff. But I think, for one, we don't talk about the minor prophets in Sunday school because they're not narrative, which I'm not saying we should necessarily add that to the curriculum, but I think that just breeds a lack of familiarity with them. And so we're maybe scared to approach it because it's not what we're comfortable with, and it's not super easy to discern on the surface. And there's a lot of chaos to the structure sometimes, but there is structure. And yeah. I think another thing is that the prophets have a lot of hard messages to say, and they weren't really heard that well in their own day. And I think they say a lot of things that are difficult for modern readers to hear too.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, that's whenever I think about the minor prophets, maybe this is wrong on my end, but I think about really just like, with some exceptions, like Jonah, probably the most well-known minor prophet.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's the most narrative book
exactly,
of them all.
Exactly, yeah.
Probably not a coincidence. But whenever I think about prophets, minor prophets, in general, there are exceptions. I think of like just a massive scathing rebuke with like a glimpse of hope at the very
yeah,
end.
Yeah,
like most of them almost seem to follow that, you know, kind of general form. It's like, okay. And it, it's pretty intense, especially when you start digging into like the history behind it and everything. But that's like necessary. You can't enter the minor prophets and try to study without looking at their context,
absolutely,
and who they were talking to and everything like that. So maybe that's part of why they're neglected, a little extra work on the front end. But speaking of these themes we see running through, what are some things, I know you've been studying the minor prophets lately, what are some things you see kind of like, you know, if people listening to this podcast are going to read through the minor prophets, what are some things they should be on the lookout for?
Okay.
That kind of, you know, themes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you touched on it a little bit. It's a lot of rebuke and judgment, and then you have this hope. So I think something that you see almost in every minor prophet, of course there are exceptions, is this dual nature of God's love and compassion and his desire to preserve his people, the remnant, and to bring about his purposes through his people Israel, but also his justice, and even on all these foreign nations, but also on his own people, that he has to bring justice, and he has to bring this condemnation, but even in that, he's working his purposes. So that's a huge theme. I think that would be the overarching theme of the minor prophets. And then another thing along with that would be just the way that God is very active in the world, in the events of history. He's using, for one, prophets to speak his message to people, but he's also using evil kings and evil nations to bring about his purposes. And I think one major theme that comes out in the Minor Prophets is that God is at work in the world. He's not an aloof God. He's not sitting back. He's very involved in it and very concerned about the direction of history and the course of humanity and where we're going. And so I think that jumps out to me in the Minor Prophets, especially. And there's also, but there is also this sense of hope amidst this justice that is coming. Mm-hmm. And another theme that I think is especially relevant for us today in our world, a world that is very finely, especially our generation, that's very attuned to issues of social justice, that comes across so clearly in the Minor Prophets, about concern for the weak, for the poor, about calling out leaders and wealthy people who are abusing the poor and taking advantage of them. And God clearly hates that, and that's one clear reason why he is bringing judgment on a lot of these books, is that this idea of Israel not loving their neighbor, not having a society that upholds justice like they're supposed to. And I think that could really speak into our culture if we talked about these things more. But it's not a social justice that is based on kind of the flimsy whims of our modern day society. It's a justice that is rooted in God's character and who he is as a just and loving God. But Israel and Judah over and over are straying away from the covenant and straying away from loving God. They go into idolatry and they stray away from loving their neighbor. They're abusing all the weakest of society. And that's what God is really concerned about. And so the prophets, their main responsibility and their main duty is to try to call the people back to covenant faithfulness, to bring them back to realizing who God is and what he expects of them.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. And yeah, remember, if you think God doesn't care about the poor, definitely read the Minor Prophets.
Right.
And I mean, your mind will be blown. You'll be like, wait a second. Especially today, kind of not appropriating it, but kind of applying it to our context. I mean, we're the ones who are called to be that light of the world, and we're the ones who are called to be concerned with those who are not only physically destitute, but of course, you know, spiritually destitute as well. And it's definitely challenging to go through the Minor Prophets and to study them in that way. One thing, too, I was going to say, we were talking about things we notice in there. Remember the first time I really studied the book of Hosea, I like came to tears. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of times, like, yeah, the prophets, Minor Prophets, you do see a lot of judgment and stuff. But in Hosea, it's like God's love, at least for me, really on display. And it's like, wait a second, what? And people talk about, you know, there's that whole debate that Hosea really married Gomer, all those different stuff. But either way, you really see the point. Either way, it's illustrating God's love for his people, you know. And really, he goes, I mean, just further than anybody else would to try to help somebody. And it's, you know, this his people collectively. And just a good reminder. And I think, you know, like you were saying in the Minor Prophets, you see, not that it's like duality as in like conflicting with one another, but God is just. And God is holy, mm-hmm. but God is also loving.
Right.
And one thing that really stands out to me is kind of his impartiality. Like you're talking with, you know, he's not going to favor the rich over the poor. And he wants to save his remnant. But if Israel acts like the nations around them, they're going to be judged as well. You know, and it's kind of just a reminder of just he's just and he's impartial. And he's also loving. So I love it. I love that.
In the prophets, we see that he is bringing judgment on the nations and on his own people, but he also gives hope to the nations a lot in the Minor Prophets. Yeah. Not only in Jonah, where we see that he is sent to this evil nation, or you see the city of Assyria, the capital of this evil nation, Nineveh, this capital of the evil nation of Assyria. But there's also, in these beautiful pictures of hope, like you're talking about, there's hope for the nations. I think about Micah, where it talks about the mountain of the Lord and all peoples are going to flow to it one day. And so I think another major point in the prophets is that Israel was called to be this light to the nations, to bring blessing to the whole world. And they're failing in doing that because they have broken down the covenant. But God is determined to preserve his people so that all the nations will be blessed. And going back to that, what you said about Hosea, I think Hosea 11 is, you know, one of the best and most emotionally impactful passages in the Bible. And I think what you're saying rings so true with me. And the reason the Minor Prophets resonate, I think, so much for me is because there are these such powerful, beautiful pictures of hope in the midst of all this judgment and darkness. And I think that brings it out even more that we see how wrathful God is, how serious he is about bringing doom upon sin, but still his faithfulness in the midst of that.
Right.
Read the Minor Prophets and you will be blown away by this imagery of a God who is pursuing us and loves us, and like you said, goes way farther than we would expect anyone to go in love and compassion.
So. Yeah, definitely. I think you've pretty much already hit on this, but we are pretty far removed from the context of the Minor Prophets. There's some distance there. We got to kind of dig in to figure all that out, but there still are lessons for us today that are especially relevant. You've talked about a lot of them, but are there any more that maybe, like, you know, the Minor Prophets should be studied because they teach us about
something? Yeah, I think, like I was saying, the social justice thing is huge, especially for the American church, because a lot of us are pretty wealthy and pretty good positions, and we ought to be concerned about the poor. You know, we ought to have a discussion on how the best way to do that is, but if God has a heart for the poor and for the outcast elite, then we should too. And then beyond just that, I think the Minor Prophets, for me, as I'm reading them, reflect a lot of things in my own heart that I see that I need to change. Pride, he calls out pride. God calls out pride through his prophets a lot in these books. He calls out desire for these other things and a trust in false gods and in military might or national identity or status or whatever it is. And I think that's just as relevant to us as it was back then, because we do struggle with idolatry. It comes in a different form. We talk about that a lot in the church, I think, but it's harder to identify it in my own heart than, you know, to say that generally. But I think those are some of the big things that are relevant to us. And then beyond that, just like we were talking about earlier, rather than just the applicable lessons that we see so clearly, which we've been talking about, you just get a better picture of who God is. You just know more about God's character and how he works in the world and what he wants for my life. If we get a picture of the Minor Prophets, he didn't put them in the Bible so we could ignore them. He put them in there for a reason, so we can know better who he is.
Definitely. Yeah, that's a great point. I think too, it kind of, there's a lot of messianic language too in the Minor Prophets that kind of, and that's part of the hope that they have. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, stick together as this remnant, stay faithful. The Messiah will come. It'll be great. And it is great. So good reminder. And you see the Minor Prophets kind of echoed, alluded to, quoted in the New Testament. And I think sometimes, you know, if we're ignorant of the Minor Prophets, we'll be ignorant of that as well. And we'll just be like, what? What is this talking about?
Right.
But, you know, it's definitely applicable to us as Christians because it's talking about Jesus, our Savior.
Definitely.
Really good stuff. So, kind of personal here again, do you have a favorite Minor Prophet? If so, which one and why? And then I'll talk about that too. But you go first.
I usually answer this question saying Micah, but recently as I've been studying, it's like whatever one I'm reading right then is my favorite pretty much. Yeah. But I'll say Micah because I think, for one, I wrote my crit paper on it, which was a beast to get through, but it was really helpful to study it and get a grasp of the context and everything around it. But I think Micah, to me, best captures this kind of all the best things about the Minor Prophets that we've been talking about. There's three kind of distinct cycles of judgment, terrifying imagery of God on the mountain, like about to come down, and, you know, volcanoes and like lightning, all that kind of imagery. And then there's these startling messages of hope. You know, God's going to shepherd his people and bring them back. And then Micah chapter 4, the mountain of the Lord out of Zion shall go forth the law, and all people shall come to it, and the lame are going to be gathered, and, you know, all this kind of imagery that's just really powerful. And I think Micah really strikes at the heart of God wanting us to be just, you know, the famous passage from Micah 6. And it also points powerfully toward Jesus in a lot of ways. Micah 5:2 is a verse that a lot of people come to about predicting that Jesus is going to come from Bethlehem. But more than that, it points to Messiah as this shepherd figure, as this loving king that's going to come. And so for those reasons, I think Micah really resonates with me a lot.
Yeah, that's great. I think Micah is definitely a great one. Probably, let me think about this. I don't want to say, I should avoid categorical speech, but Micah, at least in our generation, or generations around our generation, is probably like the most popular baby name from the Minor Prophets.
Yeah.
Like Joel probably ruled for a while, you know what I mean? But I feel like I know a lot of Micahs.
Yeah, there are a lot of Micahs. A lot of girls are named Micah too, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think that's a modern development. So I don't know where Micah is on the baby name rankings. I don't know. Maybe I could include that in the show notes.
Do some research on that. Yeah.
Don't know any Obadiahs.
No.
But that's neither here nor there. Habakkuk would be a good one.
Yeah.
I have a kid. I had a teacher. He probably won't listen to this. I used to have a teacher who said that the last book in the Old Testament was the only Italian prophet, Malachi, which just is a horrible joke. But anyway, yeah. So Micah's a good one. I think Micah is probably my favorite. I don't know. Micah is my favorite one to read. Maybe Hosea. Hosea might be my favorite one to read.
Yeah.
Amos is like my favorite like prophet though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I don't know why. I'm just attracted to just his background. He was intense, and he was like a blue collar guy.
Oh yeah.
Like he was like
fig farmer and shepherd.
Yeah. There's a big debate over like, well, if he was a shepherd, he must have been pretty well off. But like he was from, let me get this right. Yeah. He was, you know, he was kind of a blue collar guy going outside of his own culture.
Yeah.
You know, and talking to kind of the lavish lifestyle of those who were, you know, outside of his own demographic. But
a lot of the Minor Prophets were kind of backwoods guys, it seems.
Yeah. And it's almost like that John the Baptizer feel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where it's just like, I'm out in the wilderness just eating bugs. And if I got to call you out, I will.
Calling out the powerful people, speaking truth to power kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. It's needed. But I struggle too. Like, I don't want to identify too much with the prophet.
Right.
Because I'm probably more like the people he was calling out.
You know
what I mean? Which is something
something
I forget sometimes. But yeah, Amos is a great one. I love it a lot. And but yeah.
What I like about Amos is that he pulls out another theme that's really powerful in the Minor Prophets, is that God hates your worship if your heart is not right and if you're not treating your neighbor right. Because I think there's a passage, it's maybe Amos 5 or 6, where he says that God hates your feast. He hates the noise of your songs. He hates all these things that you're doing in worship because you're not treating the poor right and you don't really love God and you're not really seeking him and trying to be faithful. So you're doing all these outward things, but your heart is not right and you don't really love God. And so I think that's another hugely relevant thing for our culture.
Absolutely, especially with Amos, you know, like, especially, you know, in the church, like, Amos, his audience, at least from what I know, from what he calls them out for, they were worshiping, they were offering things to God that he had asked for.
Yeah.
Like, they were doing what he wanted, just not the way they should have been. You know what I mean? Like, they were going through the right things, but they were, their heart wasn't in it. They were, you know, they loved themselves or their money or their wealth or whatever more. And God was like, just stop, just cut it out. I know I asked for this, but I don't want it if you're not going to be all in it.
Yeah,
that's a great reminder. My favorite, it's pretty intense, like I said, you know, the Minor Prophets, like we've been saying, my favorite thing, my favorite like episode in Amos, I think you could turn this into a play, is when he goes and visits like the cultic priests of, Baal, yeah. I'm pretty sure like in the north, you know, they had the priests for the idolatrous mm-hmm. worship, and he's kind of talking to the king, and then the priest comes in and tells him to stop prophesying, and then his reply is, pretty soon, man, I should have read this. I meant to look it up before I came out, but he's like, stop prophesying. And Amos is like, okay, like your kids are going to die in the streets and your wife's going to be a prostitute. And then he leaves. Like, yeah. That's his like mic drop moment. And it's like, whoa. Like, and he really just was like, talk about a guy who was just trying to do what God had told him to do. Like, he didn't really care. Like, that's like some scary stuff. You know, yeah, you see like Jeremiah. Intense. Obviously, Jeremiah's not a minor prophet, but like these prophets weren't always treated well. Like, you see that throughout. So kind of just having the courage to do what God has called you, you know, I think is huge, a huge lesson.
Definitely.
From them. Okay, and we kind of already touched on this. This is something we kind of prepared to talk about, but if you've already touched on it, don't worry about it. So you've kind of been helping teach through the minor prophets and teaching through the minor prophets at church. What has really kind of jumped out to you in doing that? Like, what is, like, a couple of gems, a couple of nuggets for the folks at home?
Yeah, okay. One thing that I don't think I've talked about too much, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but I think one thing that was really interesting through this study is that I've noticed a lot of imagery in the prophets that are supposed to call us back to Exodus, the Exodus narrative. So there's a lot of Sinai imagery. Several of the books have this picture of kind of God's judgment coming down on a mountain and like God's presence being on the mountain, just like at Sinai where, you know, there's like this earthquake and there's like flashes of lightning.
Yeah.
And we see that kind of imagery a lot in several of the minor prophets. And then also connecting with that idea of Exodus, there's all this language in the prophets about trying to get Israel to remember what God has done for them in bringing them out of Egypt. Like, that was supposed to be like the seminal moment, like foundational moment of their story. And they've forgotten what God had done for them. And so they've started to become just like Egypt was to them. They become the oppressors. And that comes out a lot in the minor prophets. Hosea 11:1, it comes to mind where it says, out of Egypt I called my son. And the rest of the chapter is all about how God loved Israel as a father and is, you know, bringing him up. But it all started with calling him out of Egypt and bringing him powerfully and showing who he was and that covenant commitment at Sinai during the book of Exodus. And really, that's what the minor prophets are all about, because Israel and Judah have broken the covenant.
Right.
They've broken that relationship. And so the minor prophets are trying to bring that back. And so I thought that was really cool, the connections between Exodus, which, you know, brings us back to the whole literary discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're a reader of scripture and you have sat with Exodus a lot and have really tried to see the themes and the images that are present there, that helps you read the minor prophets or whatever else it is in the Bible, because these biblical authors, I think, are drawing off each other all the time.
Definitely. That's a great point. And wow, that's cool. I'd never really noticed that, but it makes sense with what you were saying about the prophets, really their main job being calling people back to the covenant. And it would make sense that they would use the imagery of when the covenant, when they entered into it, you know what I mean? Kind of calling back. And I think Paul, I don't want to draw a line, you know, too clear in the sand, but what am I trying to say? I don't want to stretch anything, but I think Paul might do the same thing sometimes when he references baptism, you know what I mean? Because especially like in Romans 6, he says, you know, obviously he's using that rhetorical questions of like, you guys all know that everybody who's a Christian was baptized and this is what happened. And then he launch pads off of that into, that whole discussion about no longer being enslaved to sin. It's almost like a reminder, like, hey, look, like, you put this away. Like, you're done. You know what I mean? You died to sin. Why are you picking it back up? Or why would you? You know, and I think you might do the same thing in Galatians too, kind of with, like, you're freed. You know, you're all at one, and now you're dividing and biting and devouring each other. So I think that's cool, kind of just a reminder of, like, look, we have an agreement, and this is what happened, and you're kind of straying away from it.
And I think baptism really is a image and a picture that draws from the Exodus narrative, in that crossing the Red Sea was this, you know, huge moment for them, and involved passing through the waters. And so I think, I mean, I don't want to stretch that too much either, but I think that's a powerful image, and I think it connects pretty well.
Absolutely. I mean, Paul said, you can't stretch any more than Paul did in 1 Corinthians 10.
Said, you passed through the...
Yeah, it's like all of Israel was baptized, you know what I mean, in the Red Sea. So a lot of imagery there, kind of just leaving that life behind you. But then when you go through that Red Sea moment and you start living like from what you were saved from, time for a wake-up call. And that's essentially, you know, the role of the minor prophets. So pretty cool. So what, I know this is kind of off the top of our heads, but what would you give people who maybe have never studied the minor prophets before? Maybe just some tips, you know, for them to kind of get into it, some advice maybe. Maybe where to start, you know, just so that they can get something out of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of good resources out there. I've been using Jack Lewis's little book called The Minor Prophets. It's pretty short, but it gives a lot of good historical information, and but it's pretty brief and pretty easy to read. So if you can find that book, we actually sell it at Hester Publications. So a little plug for that. But but that's a really good helpful tool. There's a lot of online resources about the history and things, but really where to start, I mean, this is going to sound super simple, but just read the Minor Prophets. Like, I think so many people get so scared, or they're timid in approaching them, and they just never sit down and read them. So just decide to read a whole book in its entirety in one sitting. You know, just set out some time for that. Think about it, meditate upon it, write notes, ask questions. What does this mean? What is this city name, or what is this king name? And then from there, once you have those questions, you can go to all these resources online and books and stuff. But I think sit with it yourself first is the best way to start for anyone wanting to read the Minor Prophets.
So. Awesome. And maybe one benefit of the Minor Prophets, not that... I mean, I don't want to assume everybody hates reading. That's not what I'm trying to say. But, I mean, you could read a whole Minor Prophet in one sitting pretty easily, usually.
Yeah.
The longest one probably still takes less than 30 minutes, maybe, depending on your, you know, reading speed.
Might a lot of them are really short, yeah.
All of them definitely less than an hour.
Yeah, you know what I mean? For sure.
So definitely something worth digging into and looking out for. And maybe I'll put a link to that book in the show notes. If you go to theologyetc.org, click on this episode, you'll be able to find a link for that there, maybe. Is it sold online?
Yeah, I think it is sold online. Okay. I would have to check on that, but I'm pretty sure it is.
There'll be a link either way. Whether or not it leads to what you're looking for will be another question. But Andy, I appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was really, really fun discussion, so awesome. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Really, really appreciate you. And if you have any questions, if you have any comments, love to hear from those. Theology ETC, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. You can email contact@theologyetc.org if you have a question, a comment, something you want me to pass on to Andy. But we appreciate him, and we hope that, you know, maybe this has helped you in some way, either fall in love with God's Word a little bit more eager to go and to study, maybe more eager to go and study the Minor Prophets and reap the benefits of doing that. Either way, thank you for tuning in, and God bless. Thank you.